So, so we have this pass integral, right? And so, so this pass integral involves the integration over all configurations, and then there is a huge redundancy, right? So there's a diffeomorphism involved. And so the way how I can think, how we can think about this integral is that this is a whole space. This is a whole space of configurations, and so there are two ways. So we have to integrate over all of them. So I'm just going to draw a line here, and so this is a gauge slice, right? So this is a gauge slice. A gauge slice. Which means that if I do, if I start at this point, right, and so if I do a diffeomorphism transformation on my fields or wild transformation, I will move to the left or to the right. Okay, so this is of course this multidimensional space, but I'm drawing this just as a line. So by saying that that's a gauge slice, it means that doing diffeomorphism or wild transformation moves me along the slice. Okay. And so this type of changes, so of course, naively, that will correspond to a different configuration that we have to include in the pass integral. But they are not physical. They are related by gauge transformations. And so in fact, what we want to do, we want to make our integral, we want to integrate along the trajectories, which are always perpendicular to this gauge slice. So we want to intersect, so this is integrating over trajectories. Over trajectories. Oh, no, bad. I intersect. Each gauge slice once. So if we do that, then in this pass integral, so before the pass integral was the integral over dx, dg, right, over volume of the diffeomorphism times volume of the wild. So once we integrate along the directions which are normal to this gauge slicing, so then we integrate over just the physical degrees of freedom dx, right? So we kind of evaluated the dividing part in the pass integral by the diffeomorphism and wild transformation. Of course, what we would have to do, so that's the idea for gauge fixing. So we our gauge degrees of freedom are diffeomorphism and wild transformations. And fixing gauge degrees of freedom, so I'm canceling these volumes in the denominator. So is it clear what they said?
Yeah, I have a line question.
Right.
When we do the point of view theory, it seems we do not care about the degree of morphism. Although the theory also always.
Right, because you formulate your quantum field theory in flat space. Right. So now, what am I? Okay, so you guys don't have questions, and I do have a question. So, what am I implicitly saying here? Okay, I told you that once I do that, then I am canceling the denominator. When is this correct? I'm asking a question. So I was telling this picture is a gauge fixing, and I was saying that once I integrate, so I choose a particular point, and then on each gauge slice, I choose a particular point, and I integrate along the trajectory, intersects each gauge slice once. And I'm saying that that corresponds to dividing, to writing, just omitting the denominator. What am I assuming here?
So, a change of variables to open.
Well, we'll handle with that. Yeah, there will be a gauge fixing, but I'm saying there is something that I'm missing. So if you, what you are missing right now, you're missing the fact that the string theory will only live in 46 dimensions or critical dimension. But this is a place, which will separate whether you're missing or not. What's implicit assumption, right? So when I'm saying that that's the case, I'm saying that this trajectory and this trajectory is the same,
right?
So if I choose a trajectory that slices each gate slice in this way or in some other place, so I can go from one to another by doing a diffeomorphism and wild transformation. All I'm saying by doing that I will get the same answer times a constant, and that's why I have been able to cancel this constant in the denominator. So what I have been assuming here is that an integration of a different physical trajectory, I will call it the physical trajectory, produces the same answer. In other words, the assumption here is that diffeomorphism plus wild symmetry is exact quantum mechanical. Okay? So we're talking about exact. What we will find out is that in general there will be anomalies in this. So we know that these symmetries are classically correct, right? Because the action there is invariant on the diffeomorphism and wild symmetries. But this is inside the path integral, which includes all quantum corrections. And so, in quantum field theories, this can happen. This can happen that your gauge symmetries become anomalous. And if that happens, you're usually in a bad shape, usually very, very bad shape. You either violate unitarity or, you know, something really bad happens. So you never want to have anomalous gauge symmetry. And so it will turn out that, in particular, when we require, so the first thing is that we will find out that in order to have, this is what I'm not going to show, but I'm just going to mention here that if you want diffeomorphism invariants to be anomaly free, remember that we looked at central charges of the CFTs that can have different central charges. It turns out that unless the central charges are the same in a holomorphic and anti-holomorphic set, the diffeomorphism invariance is broken. Okay? And unless the total central charge is zero, the wild symmetry is broken. Which means that everything that we're going to do now, right, and what we are going to do, we're going to fix a metric to this particular form, and we can do that only if this symmetry is exact quantum mechanically. Okay? So everything that we do from now will be wrong unless, at the end of the day, the total central charge of the theory will be equal to zero. Because see, once I write it down in this way, then I'm dealing with a conformal theory for this X system, right? So that's a conformal CFT. And so I'm asking the question, what's the central charge of that? So the issue here, somebody already mentioned that there are Fadier-Popov determinants. That's what we're going to discuss. So we'll find out that there is a contribution to the central charge of the CFT in this conformal gauge coming from this Fadier-Popov determinant. And so here, the condition that these symmetries are exact quantum mechanically will actually lead us to their critical dimension of the string. Okay? Good. So let's go ahead. And so we will worry later about this, and we will study later how does anomaly arise if we move along the gauge slice. But for now, so let's fix, we're sitting in this gauge fixed size, which means that delta our metric GAP is GAP half, which is delta A.
Right. So let's ask, do you have any problems calculating semi-classical approximation? So like several approximation in calculating this?
Yes.
So
this is a past integral perspective. But in quantum field theories, anomalies arises at one root level. So in fact, in particular, when we talk about chiral anomalies in gauge series, so those are kind of similar things that there is a symmetry that's exact classically, but it's anomalous once you include quantum corrections. So if you take a quantum field series, then anomalies typically arise at one loop level. And moreover, so in say chiral anomalies, as I mentioned, the violation of the symmetry, how the symmetry is violated, is just completely determined by one loop result. So it cannot be shown. Meaning that further correction to the violation from higher loops doesn't show up. Right, because I'm assuming that you guys already passed quantum field theory 2, which I know some of you are just taking. But that's kind of fun thing that that you see there. Okay, so very good. So now we have to go ahead and compute the path integral along this physical trajectory. And so the first thing we need to discuss are the Fadeev-Popov called determinants, right? Determinants. And so in general, so let's describe mathematics as a type of gauge symmetries that I'm doing. So this psi, so this moving left to the right is acting with psi. And so this psi is the transformation when I start with symmetric GAB. And so it goes to GAB psi as a function of sigma prime. And so this equals e to the 2 omega of sigma. So this psi involves a wild transformation. And it involves the diffeomorphisms. So del sigma, sigma c over del sigma prime a, del sigma d over del sigma prime d. Right? And so here I have GCD. So this is a general gauge symmetry moving along the slice. So this is diffeo, and this is y. As a gauge series, it's helpful if you've seen this before, but if not, I'll try to be consistent. But please ask me questions. There will be questions. So we're going to introduce a Fadeev-Popov method. Okay, and I'm going to introduce it in such way. So 1 equals this Fadeev-Popov measure. So it will depend on fiducial metric. By fiducial metric, I mean this gauge fixed metric. Okay, you can think of this as gauge fixed metric. And so here is an integral inside the function g minus g psi. Okay. So so what I mean here is the following fact, right? So you know that if I have an integral dx and I have delta function of x minus say x naught, so this equals to 1. But in general, if I have an integral of dx, and here I have a delta function, say f of x minus f of x naught, right? So this integral, so this is an integral of a delta function, so this integral is not equal to 1, but this integral is equal to what? Right. 1 over
prime.
F prime of x naught, right? Yeah. So you can see it that on this one dimensional example, I have 1 here and I have F prime of x naught, right? So this is my Fadeev-Popov determinant in this one dimensional example, right? And the reason it arises because when I introduce delta function, I introduce a delta function which depends in a functional way on the parameter over which I integrate. So the story is exactly the same here. So here I have parameters of my symmetry group, right? But I integrate with respect to metric that depends on this transformation parameter, right? So this is very much like the situation here. So the meaning of this Fourier-Foucault measure is exactly this additional piece that is necessary to go. So for example, if I would have here an integral of dg of delta function of g minus g, dg zeta, then this integral would be equal to 1, which is exactly the same that if here I would integrate dm of x, right, delta function of f minus f of 0, so this integral up here would also be 1. So the non-trivial fact of the Fourier-Foucault determinant comes because we integrate over h degrees of freedom, and but what depends here on the gauge degree of freedom are metrics. So it's a non-trivial functional, and it depends in the way our described. That's the one above. Okay, so we're going to make the following two assumptions that can be justified, but I'm not going to use this justification here. So the first assumption, so we assume that the measure is gauge invariant. Okay, so there is a way of introducing a gauge invariant measure on a symmetry group space, right? So that's always possible. So we assume that this measure is gauge invariant. And the second assumption that we're going to make is that the delta function is gauge invariant. We assume that delta function is gauge invariant. And so that's kind of obvious thing, right? So the delta function integrated. So if I have this integral, delta function of psi minus psi naught equals to 1. So that's how we define a functional delta function. So if we're going to say that the measure is invariant, okay, 1 is a number, it's invariant, then the delta function must be invariant. So let's say that's a simple statement, but we still have to assume it. Okay? So given that, we can prove that. So given these two things, we can show that the Fourier-Foucault determinant is actually gauge invariant. Okay, so the Fourier-Foucault determinant, when I evaluate at G, so this is my metric G sitting at this point here, and then I can act with psi, so here I will get the metric G psi, and so the Fourier-Foucault determinant is actually unchanged. So the Fourier-Foucault determinant evaluated at G and G psi, which is obtained as they move along the gauge slice, will not change. So let's prove this statement. So by definition, what we mean by this Fourier-Foucault of G psi is a minus 1. So I'm moving this guy on the left. So this equals the integral d psi prime, right? Delta function of d psi minus d psi prime. So what I'm doing, so this delta function measures the difference between two metrics on the gauge slice. And so what I can do, right? So I can move, I can act on this with a gauge transformation and use the fact that delta function is gauge invariant. So what I'm saying is that, let me draw you a cartoon picture here. So this is our gauge slice. So this is psi prime. And so what I can do, I can act with gauge transformations and compute the difference by moving this guy to the identity. Okay, so I move this guy. I want to move this guy along the gauge slice to identity, which means that I act on this with psi to minus 1 transformation. But then once this guy moves to the identity, right, and this field circle. So if this guy moves to one, then this guy will move to psi minus one, psi prime. Okay? So I have to act with the same symmetry transformation on both g psi and g psi prime. So then my integral becomes a delta function. So identity tells me that I have back symmetric G, and then here I have minus G psi minus 1 psi prime. Okay. Now what I can do, I can just simply change the variables of integration. I'm going to call this guy psi double prime. Okay. So what I did, I just shifted integration along the gate slice. Instead of integrating with respect to psi prime, I'm integrating psi minus one times psi prime. And so this, using the invariance of the measure, I can write this down in this form, delta g minus g psi prime. But this is precisely what we call quadratic or determinant of the metric G. Okay, so we demonstrated that a quadratic or determinant is invariant. Okay, so pretty good. So now we're going to do exactly the same steps as people do when they talk about H series. So we're going to insert this Fourier-Foucault determinant inside the path integral. So I'm going to write down my path integral to have an explicit dependence on this g hat. Okay. So the g hat is this. So this was our physical slice. Physical slice and the metric here is g hat. Right? So that's a fiducial metric. So I'm writing down this explicit dependence. The reason why we want to keep this explicit dependence, because later we want to, remember, we want to look for anomalies in the symmetries. So we would like to move from one g hat to another one and see if the position function stays the same here. So we keep explicit dependence on position. And so what I did is the following. So before we had this integral dg, so volume of the intermorphism times volume of the y, and then I have e to the minus s, which was dependent on x and g. The analogy is S and G. So that's the original quadratic path integral. And so what I did, I multiplied it by 1. Okay? But I multiplied it by 1, which is this path integral. Okay? So that's the 1 that I'm going to write down there, times 1. And this one is going to be a Fourier-Foucault determinant as a function of. And then I have a delta function of g minus g psi, and I have one additional integration here with respect to g psi. Okay, so is that clear? Very good. So, so I told you that the problem with this for determinant arises because we integrate metric with respect to del psi, but this integral is very simple. Okay, so if I integrate with respect to GG, then what I'm going to get, I'm going to get one. So I can explicitly compute this integral first, and so I will be left with the integral of d psi, and then I have d x. I have to divide. I have to divide by the dphi cross phi. And then I have a delta again for all. So now once I integrate with respect to delta function, whenever I see g, I have to substitute this argument as the delta function. So it's going to be g hat of psi, right? So this is the initial metric. And then I have e to the minus s, that depends on x, and g hat of psi. So, good. So now the next step to do is to say that so x, the matrix of dx does not depend on these transformations, right? So our field was our field x, it was a scalar. And moreover, this guy is invariant under psi transformation, so I can remove psi from here. It doesn't depend on psi. So there is no dependence on psi. And the action itself is invariant, right? So it doesn't depend on psi, so I can remove. Okay, so you can see that in this pass integral, nothing depends on psi. So the only dependence on psi comes from here. But the integral with respect to d psi must be exactly the volume of symmetry transformation. So this integral here will cancel exactly what I have in the denominator. And so we will have an integral of dx. And then by here we'll call the determinant of g psi, and then I have e to the minus s x g x. Okay? So again, the point is that we started writing down the pass integral for a single string, and it has a lot of symmetries. And then we said that we want to evaluate only along their gauge non-invariant or along the orbit, which is not a redundancy. And so restricting to the fact that our integration trajectory intersects each gauge orbit once reduced for us this Fourier Foucault determinant. And in doing so, we remove this denominator. Very good. So, if you have any question, now is the time to ask about the steps that we have done so far. Good. So the next step is that we want to evaluate this by the model. Okay. So we want to compute Okay, so for now it depends on g hat. I didn't say anything what this g hat is,
Wait, so
to the action, why the action cannot depend on the size?
Because it's invariant, this is a classical action, and it's invariant under diffeomorphism and wild transformation. That's why it doesn't depend on the size.
But if you do the diffeomorphic transformation, you should change in the scalar field.
Yeah, I have to change from sigma coordinate to sigma prime, but the action will look exactly the same way. So the integral over d sigma will be exactly the same as the integral with respect to sigma prime. Right, so the classical, what enters in the past integral is a classical action, and that was invariant under diffeomorphism. So the only, you can see that the only problem and the only subtleties can come up only from the mesh of integration. And so this gauge fixing produced for us is by the Popov determinant. That's just a simple additional piece. Okay, so very good. So let's go back. Let's go back and recall our definition of the Fourier-Popov determinant, right? So delta Fourier-Popov, delta Fourier-Popov minus one function of the Fourier metric equals to an integral of d psi, and here I have delta g times g star. Okay, so the delta function will pick up the values. I think I'm getting lost with where I have. I don't have to keep tabs. Let me do. So the delta function will pick up the values of psi such that gf equals to gf psi, right? So in general, if we have a complete gauge fixing, then there is a unique solution to this, right? So if I have a complete gauge fixing so that my trajectory indeed intersects only once, which means that this identity implies that psi equals to one. So out of this huge group of diffeomorphism and wild transformation, it's only the identity for which that thing holds true. So we're going to assume that that's the case, even though that we know that there is a measure zero left over, but let's just proceed. Let's just proceed assuming that we fix it. And so now, what I want to do, I want to ask the question, how does my metric transform under infinitesimal transformations, right? So when sigma is very close, when this psi is very close to the identity element. So for psi, near identity, so we have sigma prime A. So this, we must have infinitesimal diffeomorphism and wild transformations. So sigma prime A equals sigma A plus delta sigma A, right? So there is an infinitesimal transformation of my coordinates, and then there is an infinitesimal transformation of my wild parameter. So so normally we're going to fix conformal gauge, right? So we're going to choose delta A metric being just a flat metric. So so we start with a wild factor, which is one, and so that changes to delta omega, okay? And so I'm saying that those are the changes due to moving slightly from the identity along the gauge slice, okay? What I want to do, I want to know how does my metric change, if I make this change of variable, and I unfortunately, I think I deleted. Remember, there was a general transformation, right? So G A B was going to G prime A B, which is e to the two omega, Right, and then here there was del sigma over del sigma prime, del sigma over del sigma prime times g, right? I'm not writing down the indices. So that was the way how the metric transform in general are the arbitrary psi transformations. But now what I have to do, I'm going to ask how does my metric transform if I do linearized transformation. So I'm very close to the identity. The reason why I can do close to the identity because delta function only cares how does the argument of it vanishes, right? So it's exactly the same when we talked about the delta function of dx f of x minus f of x 0, right? So that delta function didn't care how does the function look like away from x naught. It only cared how does that how that function behaves near x naught to leading order, right? And that's exactly what we're doing. That's why even though you might think first look, you're doing just only leading order, so you are not doing it exactly, but I claim that we do it exactly because of the delta function that eventually rules this result. So the metric transformation, so there will be corrections that come from changing this and come from here. So if you do the arithmetic, what you will find out is it's two times delta omega GAB, right? So this is an obvious fact, right? So you have exponential, and so omega changed by 1 plus delta omega, so there will be a change 2 times delta omega GAB. And then there are transformations coming from infinitesimal transformations there. And so that equals to minus lambda. I'm just going to write down the formula and refer to our favorite textbook. So this is a way how the metric will transform under infinitesimal diffeomorphism transformation. So here I mean a covariant derivative. So if I have nabla A acted on a vector with a lower index BB, so this is del A BB minus Christopher connection C A B B C, right? And the Christopher connection, the MSC AB is 1 half GCK. And then here I have del A GBK plus del B GKK minus del K GAB. Again, this is simple to derive. You just have to use this infinitesimal transformation and expand it to leading order, and this is what you can do. And so I can write this down one more. I can write down one more line here. Just doing an algebra. So I can write this down as 2 delta omega minus nabla C delta sigma C delta times G A B. Okay. So right, so you can see there will be a piece. Well, if you do all the algebra, you will find out that that's the case. And then there is minus 2. I'm going to write it down P1 delta sigma times AB. So what I introduced here, P1 delta sigma of AB, is going to be equal to 1 half alpha A delta sigma B plus nabla B delta sigma A and minus G A B okay. So what I did, I just took what I had here and I decomposed it, right, into a traceless part. So this is a symmetric traceless part and I extracted the trace. Okay, and in doing so, I introduced this very neat operator Q1. So this is a differential operator that maps covariant vectors into two forms, right? So it maps it into an object with a lower index into an object with two lower indices. Okay, very good. So so now we can go ahead and evaluate this delta function. Okay. So this idea for core determinant is a minus one of the differential metric is going to be equal to the integral, right? So now I can write explicitly the measure of integration. So I have to integrate over all wild parameters d omega, right? And I also have to integrate over d delta omega and d delta sigma. So those are the sort of local coordinates that specify moving along the gauge slice. And then here I have a delta function of the difference between the metric, and the difference between the metric is going to be minus delta g a d. So in other words, the inverse of the for determinant is d delta omega d delta sigma. And then I have delta function of minus 2 delta omega minus nabla c delta sigma c g a b. And finally, I have plus 2p1. Okay, I'm going to write now the index here plus 2p1 delta sigma. Okay, so any questions so far? Yeah.
I really don't understand what you mean by d delta sigma. Is integrating over delta sigma?
All possible functions. So think of that I choose some complete set of functions. And I write down delta sigma. Think about Fourier expansion, if you wish. And so I write delta omega as a Fourier expansion over. So this integral will become an infinite dimensional integral over Fourier coefficients. You know where we talked about the kind of similar thing when we talked about Schrodinger wave function, right? So we have to integrate over all possible values of x at the boundary. Right, so that was a functional integral. But what we did there, we expanded into Fourier modes. And we said that integrating over all possible axes at the boundary is the same as integrating over the coefficients of the Fourier modes.
Yes, but this is delta sigma, not sigma.
And that's enough, right? Because this delta sigma, so we have to integrate, over. Right, so I guess you are saying that there is an integral over the gauge slice, right? And I'm saying that it was a little bit misleading. I was writing it as a one-dimensional thing. But in this, not sigma, psi, in this psi transformation, I can easily do this, okay? So this is an example of psi transformation. I do a transformation at which I just do infinitesimal change of coordinates. So that's an example of psi. And then another example of psi is just to change omega into delta omega. Okay. So those guys, they are like constant values, right? So they correspond to identity. And so integrating over all psi correspond to three integrals, right? There are three independent functions. This goes back to the counting that we did before. How many degrees of freedom? How many degrees of freedom we have? We have two reparametrization and one wild, which means that there must be three functional integrals. So these are two functional integrals. I can do arbitrary delta sigma a, delta sigma one, delta sigma two. That's two, and there is one wild. So here, what I have here is what I was denoting before as del
as dxr. Okay. Now I have been explicit.
There is no constraint in that.
Okay. So in general, I can do this transformation independent.
So the issues of the constraints, you know, will lead us to this mismatch, which is measure zero. But I'm doing now generic transformation. So this single slice, correct, when I was writing down the gauge slice as a line, is a manifold itself. And in that manifold, there is a particular line that corresponds to conformal plus wild transformation. But I'm not staying there. I look at the generic one. Okay? And that generic one corresponds to three functional intervals.
Okay, so very good.
All right, guys. Now I have to do time management because I don't want to stop at a stupid place, which would imply I have to redo everything next time. So let's go ahead. So I'm going to write down this in better form, and then we'll stop. So we have to continue massaging this integral, and so let me go into some aside, and remind you something. So again, so let's look at the simple delta function, right? So delta function of a simple variable. So one way that you learn in your undergraduate math class is that the delta function of x, right, is an integral over d beta e to the 2 pi I beta x. So this is a Fourier integral representation of a delta function. You are familiar with that, I'm assuming, right? And here, I'm writing down proportionality. It depends how you normalize your Fourier coefficients. Is it 1 over 2 pi, 1 over root 2 pi? It doesn't matter. So it's up to a constant. It's given by this integral. So if I have that, you might imagine that I should be able, there is an analog of this one-dimensional formula into a functional formula. And so this tells me that I can write down this delta function as one additional integral involving beta. Okay, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to write down this variable called determinant. So I'm just extending this equality sign towards here. So I have an integral with respect to d delta omega. There is d delta sigma. There is d delta sigma. And now I'm going to integrate. I'm going to integrate with respect to this additional beta, right? So beta d beta. And so what this tells me? This tells me wherever you have the delta function. Take the argument of the delta function and substitute it e to the 2 pi I beta times that. That's what it instructs me to do. And this is exactly what I'm going to do. So it's going to be e to the 2 pi I, right? Now this is a functional integral, right? So I'm just going to write it down. So this is going to be beta AB, right? And so this is the analog of the x, whatever is inside. This is the analog of x in this formula. So now you can see why I needed two indices a and b, right? The reason I needed two indices is because the combination inside here has indices a and b. So what I will have here, beta a b, and then I have minus 2 delta omega minus nabla delta sigma times g plus 2 e1 delta sigma with lower indices a and b. Okay, so that would be if I had just numbers, but actually those guys, they depend on the mode sheet. And so what I would have to do, I would have to integrate over a mode sheet. So there will be an integral, and I have to integrate with a diffeomorphic invariant measure. So there will be an integral d to sigma square root of g. Okay? So what I'm claiming is that this step to go from a delta function to the exponential representation is given up here. Okay? Are you with me, guys?
Good.
So next step is we're going to look at this integral. Okay, so I'm just going to look at this integral up here. And so the reason I'm going to look because delta omega enters in a very simple manner. And so let me integrate with respect to del omega. Right? Notice that I have 2 pi I, so now I'm going backwards, right? So now I'm trying to go from exponential form into a delta function form, right? So if I integrate with respect to del omega, so I can see that I have 2 pi I, right? And so then I integrate with respect to beta, I will get a delta function of x, right? So if I integrate with respect to del omega, I will get a delta function of what? Beta AB, right? Beta AB times GAB, right? The reason is that this delta omega is multiplied by GAB. So I will get, after I integrate with respect to del omega, I will get this condition. So so what this, is it clear?
Except for minus 2.
So minus 2 will simply mean that I will have a minus 2 here. It's, in principle, you have to worry, but you don't worry about constants. The constants in front of the delta function is minus 1 over constant. The important thing here is that further integration will restrict me when the argument of this delta function is 0, right? So this would imply that beta AB, this additional function, beta AB that I introduced, must be such. So we know that it must be symmetric because GAB was symmetric, but actually what we are finding now is that it's also traceless. Okay? Because if I do the integral with respect to delta omega first, I will get the delta function of the trace and it must vanish, which implies that I must restrict to a traceless beta ID. There must be traceless. So are there any questions? This is an important first step. So once you realize that it is traceless, so this is a constant, but I mean this is some complicated function, but it doesn't carry any indices, right? So what you have this guy times GAB. Since you have to integrate over beta, which are traceless, then this guy vanishes. See, I looked only at the integral with respect to the omega, but it allowed me to kill those terms. Okay, so it allowed me to kill the trace part completely of this beta AB. So I can write this down. So this past integral, which is a Fourier for determinant, I can write down the final expression. And that would be a good place to stop. So I'm just going to write it down as an integral of d del sigma and d beta. Right. So remember that we integrated with respect to del omega, right? And so this guy, do I put the prime here? I put the prime. So this beta prime AB equals to beta prime BA. So it's a symmetric function, and it's a traceless. Beta prime AA equals to 0. And so out of that integral, I will have what's left, e to the, so there is 2 pi I, and there is additional 2. So there are some places where 2's are actually very important. Otherwise, we'll screw up the critical dimension of the string. So here we have to keep track. So we have 4 pi I. Right? And then I have an integral of d2 sigma, and then there is beta beta prime AB, and then I have this differential operator which I call Q1 hat. Well, when I put a hat, I mean that it's evaluated with respect to a specific metric, right? So this P1 involved covariant derivatives, right? This is where we define it. And so I can evaluate it around any specific fiducial metric. And so that's what I mean by taking a hat here. And then delta sigma, AB. And so what we computed, we showed that alpha A whole determinant as a functional of a fiducial metric is given by that. And the one important thing that I'm missing is that we actually did not compute the Fedeev-Popov whole determinant, but we computed the inverse. Okay? And we showed that the inverse of the Fedeev-Popov whole determinant is given by that nice functional integral. So the next step, we're going to stop now, but I'm going to ask you, are there any questions so far? So what is important, remember that what we need in evaluating cortical path integral, in a cortical path integral, let me end up so that you will see exactly where we are heading and what's the next step that should be done. Remember that what we are doing, we're integrating, we reduce the cortical integral into this form. So you can see where the problem is, right? So the problem is that, yeah, sure, we found a nice integral representation of the Fedeev-Popov determinant, but not quite. Right? So what can this in a Poliakov integral is not the inverse of a Fedeev-Popov determinant, but the Fedeev-Popov determinant itself. And we cannot simply plug in 1 divided by z, because we have to compute a path integral with 1 divided by a functional limit. So what we end up doing is that so far those guys are all normal Bosonic fields. And next time we will start with a crash course on Grassmann variables. And we're going to rewrite this integral in terms of the fermionic coordinates. So I will explain you what I mean by fermionic integrals. And then from here, we will be able to represent not the inverse of the Fedeev-Popov determinant, but the Fedeev-Popov determinant plus 1 as some nice functional integral. And once we do that, we will be able to substitute it in the general formula. And that will produce for us, okay, so there will be an integral of something, e to the minus s goes, right? We will write down, after we go to fermionic coordinates, that Fedeev-Popov determinant as the action for the ghost field. And so the bottom line will be that a Poliakov action will be the action for the X field and the action for the ghost. And when we talk about conformal invariance, I mean, we will require conformal invariance, we will need to require a conformal invariance of the total action. Okay, so but that's next time. Right, guys? So see you next week.